What's up, everybody? My name is Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you are tuned in to Kinda Neat. Thank you guys for tuning in, as always. First things first, follow me on Twitter, at It's Intuition. Follow my man, behind the boards, Ben Shin, making the shit sound buttery, at I Am Database, base with two S's. You can follow us as a unit at Kinda Neat. YouTube.com/That's Kinda Neat or just /Kinda Neat. Either one will get you there. Where you're going to see our buddy Mark E. Basie perform. He killed it. This dude can really sing. And the song is catchy as fuck. Download that podcast app and search for Kinda Neat and subscribe. Leave a 5-star rating. Tell us who you want to see. And everything is wrapped up in a pretty package on KindaNeat.net. So I'm back in LA after 6 days because I was in Utah on a work trip and it was dope. I've never stayed that much time in Utah and I don't think that I've ever been there when the weather was this nice. I played a show one time there with Greaves, shout out to him, at a small venue called Kilby Court in like September. 1 year, maybe August, and it was like 105 degrees and it was unbearable. And then all the other times I've been there, I've been during the winter or during the rainy spring. And so this, kind of in the middle of summer, was fucking beautiful. Utah is so dope. Like, it was like ranging from about 80 to 55 at night. And so it was just perfectly warm and beautiful and sunny, but like with lots of clouds and a breeze. And we're like up in the mountains shooting the whole time. Man, it was just beautiful. I got to go fishing one day on Sunday, and it's crazy because they have this river that runs all through Park City and Provo and like Salt Lake City. Like, there's this river, the Provo River, that is actually controlled by these dams. Like, they control the temperature and the flow with these dams, and it's all specifically for fishing. So the fishing there is amazing. And if you hire a fishing guide, which we did, you know, they bring you waders, boots, poles, and lunch and all this shit, and then you got an expert there that can just kind of like look on the internet and see where they've released what temperature water and how high the river is and et cetera, et cetera. And he can look at that and like crack the matrix and go, oh, this is the part of the river that we should be fishing in. And then you go and fly fish with the dude, and fuck, me and the homie Dom that I travel with for work, like, Dom must have caught like 12 fish. He's like a very, for some reason, he's a very natural angler, I guess. And I think I reeled in about 8 or so, but this fool Dom pulled in a motherfucking 20-inch rainbow trout. My biggest was a 17-inch brown trout. He pulled in a 20-inch rainbow trout. Now, I grew up fishing for rainbow trout in a lake, and probably the biggest I ever caught as a kid was like maybe 13 inches. So to see a 20-inch fish get reeled in, it was crazy. Like, if it wasn't a catch-and-release place, this would have been a fish that you would have like put on a wall. It was giant. So that was an amazing time. And then we're also like catching lifts up, you know, ski mountains where the snow's all melted, and like shooting professional mountain bikers. And it was just very, it was a very gnarly trip. And I don't know, I had a really great time in Utah. So I feel like I would love to have like a place to retire there and just go snowboard in the winter and go out there and just be gnarly in the summer. Like, there's so many people are very active there. Everyone's either like a road biker or a mountain biker or something. Like, they all have activities. I like to chill on the couch. I like to be on the internet. But that's what I've been doing the last 6 days, and it was dope. Today on the show, we had this dude, Mark E. Basie, and I didn't really know much about him. To be honest, I found out about him through a tweet that Kendrick Lamar made where he was just like, yo, check out the homie Mark E. Basie. And I was like, oh shit. So I listened, and I was very impressed. I was like, damn, this shit is dope. And it's like a white dude who sings and has like really great, catchy pop songs that are kind of rooted in rap music. And I was impressed, and I listened to the tape like 2 times through straight, and I went, oh, I should get this kid on the show, not knowing really anything about him. It turns out that he's like a music industry veteran. Like, he's been around for a while, and it turns out he even had like a top 40 hit at one point with an old band called 2AM Club. I didn't know any of that because, as you guys know, I don't really do a lot of research. I just like to come in and learn while you guys learn. And so, I don't know, dude has stories, and fuck, his performance just right now was like so good. I'm like really mind blown. He played guitar and sang, and he was like trying to downplay his singing voice, and it was wow. Like, the song that he wrote was really catchy. Yeah, it's cool, man. He's been helping write Pia Mia's song. So that song, Let's Do It Again, that you hear on the radio, he helped write that. That's dope to me. And so I just think it's great to see a dude that's like seen the ups and downs in the industry and has is kind of a vet at this point to stick with it and start this new journey as a solo artist. It seems to me like it's going to be a successful solo career for him, just from what I heard tonight as far as his personality goes and just the talent that he has within songwriting and singing. So he has a EP out that they put out a couple months ago called the East Hollywood EP, and that's the one that I heard and went, oh, I need to talk to this dude. So I would suggest going to his SoundCloud, SoundCloud.com/Mark_E_Bassy, B-A-S-S-Y, and just listening to that EP, because if you like this conversation, then I think you'll like that record and really good summertime vibes. So we ran really long because we had a lot to talk about. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Mark E. Bassy.
I'm from the Bay Area, San Francisco, Marin, Santa Rosa, lots of places in and around there.
Where would you like call home home?
Well, my home is Los Angeles. I've been here since I was 19, 18.
Oh, so you've been here a minute.
Since 1918.
Holy shit.
It's crazy.
You're a vampire.
Like from the cowboy days to the, yeah.
That's lit.
I moved down here like right after high school. So this, LA is really home, but you know, when you're from the Bay Area, it becomes like such a point of pride, especially if you live in L.A., because you want to separate yourself and, you know, our little culture up there. But now they've merged and it's been beautiful to watch. And I've got to kind of see all of that and be a part of it in certain ways. So L.A. is home now, but my my stepdad lives in San Francisco and my mom lives in Mill Valley.
Okay.
It's a town right outside of San Francisco, so I go to Mill Valley when I go home.
I always say the Bay Area and Orange County are similar in the fact that no one ever says the actual city they're from. They're just like, Orange County or the Bay Area. And it's like,
yeah.
Why don't you just say you're from Santa Ana? Or why don't you just say you're from Bolinas?
Well, you know where Bolinas is?
I have a homie that's from Bolinas.
Oh, so
Borat of Marshall
Payne. Yeah, that's like one of my, grew up with him since day one.
You guys kind of have a similar swagger.
Yeah, yeah. He's a great guy.
Yeah, hey,
I miss that guy. Shout out Marshall Payne.
Shout out to Marshall.
Josh probably known Marshall Payne since they were like 5 years old.
I came up in the rap world with that dude. Like back in Santa Barbara, I used to throw battles and stuff, and he would be the one that would always win them.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you moved down here right as a fresh face out of high school to pursue the dream or what?
Yeah, I had a short half a year stint at UC Santa Cruz, and I was...
shout out to the Banana Slugs.
Shout out to the Banana Slugs. I did, got myself in there, but when I was there, I was heartbroken, and I was trying to figure out what to do, and I was just like abusing drugs and alcohol and not going to class, and sort of the light at the end of the tunnel was like, if I go to LA and I become a rock star, then
I can
my ex-girlfriend will want me again type shit. And that sounds sort of pathetic out loud,
but ain't that how it always works?
I guess,
like, oh,
I guess it is,
yeah.
But it really worked. I mean, well, it worked out,
yeah.
You know, it's good. It got me down there, and then, you know, I moved down here such a long time ago, and I've been part of this whole music game for so long that I've really been, like, when I was first here, there wasn't even, like, YouTube. It was, like, the early MySpace days, and, like, me and the guitar player of my group would go to all the sorority houses and fraternity houses up and down, you know, the Southern California coast, and just play our songs in, like, John Mayer style, sort of.
That's tight.
really gay. No. Sorry. I love all people.
Well, fuck, if we're self-editing ourselves, we might as well just edit that part out and be like, oh yeah, I know, really.
No, fuck it, keep it. It's all right. I love everybody. It's all good.
There we go.
It was very soft. It was like me singing with the guitar, but I grew up listening to Bay Area rap, so that's like,
I was gonna say, there's a certain breed of like white people from the Bay that are like super duper hyphy.
Yeah.
Like, if Mac Dre came on right now, would you be thiz-facing?
I could.
Yeah.
I could if I felt like it. But I wouldn't be, like, the most turned up, like, all the way, you know, holding my shirt out. Like,
yeah.
I could do it, but that's not my go-to. And even in high school, my musical ear was always much different than my friends. Unbeknownst to me, I just was always attracted to different things musically.
Like?
Like classic soul music.
Yeah.
And when I was real young, I used to live, Tracy Chapman was my landlord in San Francisco.
Yeah, really?
So my whole family lived in this like big, beautiful house, like my mom and both my aunts and their significant others, in like on Douglas Street and like sort of near Twin Peaks in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of like...
And Tracy Chapman just be there coming to pick up the rent or what?
I didn't know it at the time. It's like years later that I really found this out, but... Yeah. She owned like a few houses there, I guess. And so my mom's music, like Annie Lennox, Tracy Chapman, James Taylor, Mamas and the Papas, you know, shit like that, I just liked it. And I was always like very secure with myself as a little kid for some reason.
So you didn't need to pose like you were a gangster rap kid. So I didn't care,
yeah. I like Tupac's my all-time favorite. So yeah. I always had that going. And I love...
I'm a Biggie guy, so we are already not getting along. God damn it.
Yeah. No, but you know, I'm from the Bay. Like, I love Bay Area rap, and right. I was really into like all the Bay Area hits. And even I had like Mac Dre before he went to jail. I had like Life's a Bitch on, you know, not on cassette, but on CD when I was probably like 9 years old. And I was never tripping. I never had to like know every Bay Area rap song. I wasn't that kid. I was more searching, like going through Stevie Wonder, Donnie Hathaway, Sam Cooke. Teddy Pendergrass, like my dad was from the South too, so like a lot of old like Southern soul music, Stax Records type shit.
Only Otis child? Redding.
I was till I was 10, and then three more came.
So yeah.
I have a very complex, weird family.
So the folks split up, and then the brothers and sisters came.
Yeah.
So how'd your folks meet in the Bay if your dad's from the South?
They met in New York City in the 70s. My mom was a merchandiser, clothing designer, and my dad was a lawyer, and they were very different but very cool. And they were, my mom was really like tough on the scene, like in Studio 54. And
was your dad like a yuppie dude or what?
I mean, he was from the shit in the South, but yeah. He had kind of like got himself to this awesome place. He's from it's called Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
So that's like that side of the family really has that country Southern thing. Uh-huh. Which is really cool to have in your family, if you know, in America, I think, because it's just so such rich culture, and even though they're like crazy white people, they got a lot of soul.
Yeah,
and they taught me, like, you know, my family, they love music down there.
How did he pull himself out of that to become, or like, I don't know, I hear Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, I think like hill people and shit, and
like no, it is like it's very country.
How did he end up being a lawyer?
I mean, he just...
Just grinded it out?
Yeah, he was really smart.
Yeah, yeah.
All my family members are quite intelligent.
I like when people describe, like, they're like, my family was pretty smart. They're like, quite intelligent. Like, you know, use better adjectives and
I
shit.
Had to, all right, I have to. I'm trying to speak well for your podcast.
Hey, don't even worry, man. We could... You can...
I already called things gay. I already fucked up.
You can use as much slang as you need to.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay, so your dad gets to New York and meets your mom, and she's in Studio 54 just fucking wilding out, or what?
Well, she was really about her business. She's an awesome entrepreneur. She actually, now she owns a personal care products company called EO Products. It's like essential oil-based, organic, good-for-you shampoo, conditioner, body lotion, all that, you know, and you can get it in like Whole Foods.
Super Bay Area company.
It is, but it's growing. It's bigger than you would imagine.
I believe that it's big. It's coming. I'm just saying that sounds like some real holistic, like,
exactly.
Bay Area shit. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And she started it 20 years ago.
That's dope.
She started in San Francisco in our garage, she was an entrepreneur her whole life, and always in clothing, and you know, was with like Tommy Hilfiger and Donna Karan and all these like huge designers, and really in that part of that whole scene. So my parents just had a huge impact on my taste, and I've never been like ashamed. Some kids like really push back against what their parents like, and that's kind of how they define their taste, but my mom was too cool. I had to just accept it, and sort of the older I get, the more comfortable I get being like, I just want to make a James Taylor song,
right
a modern version, but
so they meet in New York, and then how did they end up in San Francisco?
My mom got pregnant, and she made a decision. She got offered a job at the Gap, and she didn't want to raise her child in New York City. She was also from Pittsburgh, and she loved...
Oh, my dad's from outside of Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
I got a fucking Rolling Rock tattoo because of Latrobe, PA. My dad grew up right around there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, small world.
That's crazy. Yeah, yeah. So, and I have the Pittsburgh the thick Pittsburgh bloodline too.
Yeah.
But so my mom wanted to have me out there, and my dad decided he wanted to quit and be like a personal counselor for adults in this thing called LifeSpring Training. This is fun. I never get to talk about all this. So he quit his like high profile, like started from the bottom. Now I'm a kick ass Wall Street attorney. So they both quit their jobs, moved to San Francisco,
so,
and
like,
had me
passions.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of like that. And like took massive pay cuts. And then after that, when I, you know, my dad freaked out and was like, well, I can't do that. And then he took the bar and became a lawyer in California. And my mom opened a clothing store called, it was, her name was, is Susan Griffin. And she had a clothing store in San Francisco called Susan Griffin. And they were rocking. And then they split up when I was a little kid.
How was the split? Your voice got kind of quiet, like it affected you pretty heavy.
No, 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 it didn't affect me.
It's how you're like, and then they split. And,
no,
and
I was actually just thinking, God damn, this coffee just really kicked in.
You're just
this is great coffee. Shout out to this place down the street.
Yeah. So your folks split. How old are you?
I was two.
And so, you were young. You don't even remember it, probably.
No, I don't.
Yeah. Remember. So did you spend most of the time with mom or dad, or was it like a even split?
I think that they had joint custody. And yeah, I had a very normal, good upbringing until I was like 13. My dad passed away.
Oh fuck.
Yeah, I didn't know.
I'm never ready for that when people tell me. I hear it a lot from musicians.
It was a long time ago.
No, absolutely. So I'm not one of those people that says I'm sorry, because I'm sure you've already dealt with it in your own way, and I have nothing to do with it to apologize for. But that is a sad story that your dad died at 13.
Yeah.
Have you ever read Outliers?
Yes, I have.
A lot of successful people's dads die at a very young age.
Yeah.
It's like a real thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I've just recently started reading Dave Eggers' Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, and I just started reading it this morning at 5:45 in the morning.
And you're already done with it?
No, I'm not. He talks a lot about that, but...
Really?
I recommend it.
How'd your dad pass?
He had cancer.
Oh,
was sick.
Fuck. What kind?
It was called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Oh man. And so you had to watch that?
Yeah. It really sucked, but he was really like never tripped. I don't know. He was really strong about it, and
stayed
he kinda
positive or what?
It wasn't even like it's all okay. He was just like, man, like I'm all good.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I never had a conversation with him where he was like, I can't believe this is happening, or woe is me.
Yeah.
And it kinda instilled a certain like, I have an attitude like I can do anything, sort of, from that.
After you found out, how long was it? Like, how long did you see him go through that?
It was like 3 years.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. So, but he wasn't sick. Like, he was doing really well.
Yeah.
And then it just happened really fast. Right at the end, it just kind of happened. And we actually weren't expecting it. It was, you know, his sort of, like, timeline or whatever was, it was longer initially, they thought. But I've really I've come to realize and kind of just view that whole situation as that was a blessing in its own way. Even though, you know, I think about my dad every single day.
Yeah.
And he had a huge impact on my life, but fuck, you know, that's how it is, and that's who I am. So
yeah, and I mean, you can either let it ruin you or inspire you, I guess.
Yeah.
And so you've probably chosen the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you look like your dad?
Sort of. I look a lot like my mom.
Yeah.
Also.
I mean, did your parents keep it cool?
Yeah, no. My dad told my mom he still loved her when he was on his deathbed.
What were you doing as a kid at the time? Were you good at school? Since you guys are quite intelligent?
That's the interesting part is that when he was around, I was very good at everything.
But he passed right at the time when everybody wants to start to rebel anyways. So then you had more of a reason to.
Well, actually, what's crazy... And I never really talk about this, so I'm going to use this as like a therapy session now.
Please do.
But
if you cry, I'll cry with you.
I'm not going to cry.
I'm a very empathetic person.
We weren't on good terms. Like it was already beginning. He was so hard on me.
Mm.
You know, like even an A- was bad.
Yeah.
Like I never got an A- when he was around. Like straight A student. I was probably the best basketball player in my county, in my age, grade.
Marshall Payne will probably have something to say about
that. He's older, but I was better than him, for sure, at that time.
Oh, shit.
Josh was, too. Marshall thinks he was the greatest ever, but we are all there.
No shit. Josh, you ball, too?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Marshall was good. Marshall was probably better than me, but at that time, he wasn't bullying us, so He wasn't.
I'm just fucking with you. Well, so yeah, so like you're one of those kids who's like parents expect A's. Like I was my parents were the same way, and I always hated it. Like when I'd have friends who was like, hey, if you get an A or a B, you get a money reward, and they would show me their report cards. Like, yeah, man, I got 3 B's and an A. I'm gonna get like $50. I'm like, man, I would get a whooping for that.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, that's how my dad wasn't even. My mom didn't care. My mom is the most like do whatever. My mom raised herself. And, you know, like I said, she's always been an entrepreneur and she's never cared about school and never told me. Like, my first report card that I ever got was a 3.2. Uh-huh. I remember this. My mom was like, great job, honey. You got a 3.2. That's solid. Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and my dad was like, oh, so you want to be like a 3.2 kind of guy for your whole life? And I was never thought about anything. I was like, yeah, no. He was like, absolutely not. Like, and, so I started kicking ass in school, but then after he passed away, that was done.
Why weren't you guys on good terms at that time?
We were on good terms, but it was just he had moved 2 hours away.
Oh yeah,
for the first time, him and my mom had always lived in the same city, and he had moved 2 hours north with his new wife, and there was just friction because he wanted to see me, and he was sick. So looking back, like fuck. Of course,
it was a lot to juggle.
He wanted to see me, but I didn't care if he was sick. I wanted to be, you know, how selfish you are when you're a kid. Like, I was 11, so I knew he was sick, but the thought of him passing away wasn't a reality yet. It was just like, my dad's sick, he'll be fine. He really was like a alpha male personality, so sorry. I wouldn't, you know, I couldn't see it like that, and I couldn't have the, you know, the hindsight at the time. But, so I wanted to stay. We're in the city I was in, and he wanted me to go back and forth. And I would, like, even from the age of 10, I'd be on the bus by myself going 2 hours back and forth, and it was just a lot to deal with. So there was just friction around all that. And, you know, I would have to go 2 hours away from all my friends, and I would, like, miss the parties and miss all the, you know, whatever the – that's, like, right in the age when you first – have the like freak dance parties, and I'm like,
love freak
I fucking missed the first, like, oh my god, Tiffany Sims did what and blah blah blah, and I missed everything,
right?
So and I was just up with my dad, like, you know, in this scary like house 2 hours north of everything. So that's where the friction arose, but in the end everything was great, and I mean there was no, we, you know, we patched everything up, and when he passed away we're just as good as ever.
Yeah. That's a lot to deal with as a fucking 11, 12, 13-year-old.
Yeah. And he had a son in that same, exactly a month before he passed.
Oh, my gosh.
So I have, like, and he had a daughter who was 3. Yeah. So I had, like, a whole nother family.
So he got married. He got remarried when you were how old?
Like, maybe 5 or something.
Oh, okay.
Or no. Yeah, later, like. 7 or 8 or something.
Yeah, yeah. So you had a half sister and a half brother from him.
Mm-hmm.
Are you close with them?
You know, no.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to be close with them, and it breaks my heart. But they're so good.
They still somehow live up, they still live up there, and it's just
my little sister is a freshman on like a full academic scholarship at Seton Hall, and she's so bright. It's unbelievable.
Quite intelligent, would
she's
you say?
She's way past that. She would have came with something way better.
Yeah.
She's just so like well-read and knows everything. She knows more than I do about politics, society, anything, music even. And she's just like the best kind of, like, she's beautiful, but she's like just the right type of nerd also. Like, if you know.
Yeah.
How old is she? She's the best girl. She's 19.
She's single or what? I'm fucking with you.
No, she's not. She has an awesome boyfriend too.
Nice.
I've never met him, but I stalk him a little bit just to make sure he's all right.
You have to go up there and rough him up.
Yeah, he's good. And so I have her. She's 19. I have another 19-year-old sister also who's equally awesome.
From your mom?
From my mom.
Did she remarry as well?
She remarried also and re-divorced.
Yeah. How'd you like the stepdad thing?
He's great.
He was cool?
I come from a family where no one works for anyone else. Every single person in my family is their own boss.
Yeah.
My uncles, my aunts, they have their own businesses, small or big, whatever, rich or poor. And no sustained marriages, but everyone's cool. No one's like, there's only one bitter set of exes.
Yeah.
In my whole family, and it's a lot of kids. And so it's a really, there's a lot of stories
mm-hmm.
in like I have access to so many real life, so much real life, like tragedy, joy, and hardship and everything that comes with being in a real complex, familial, urban situation. Urban meaning city, not Dr. Dre urban.
I get it.
So it's like, it was real natural for me to kind of take all this into like poetry, writing. That's how everything began.
Right.
I consider writing to be, in terms of like how I do music, that's sort of my strongest natural talent, I think, is my ability to like write. And it all comes from all that, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
It's all right there. I don't really have to look anywhere else.
So you're 13, and you say like that's when you start slacking off from school. Is that when you start kind of writing more poetry and stuff at that point?
So I never did that. I did a little bit. Like, I would sing along to rap songs, and I was into that. And I was like on the San Francisco Muni as like a little 9-year-old kid by myself with my friends too. So I always, and I lived in like it was called Potrero Hill in San Francisco. It's kind of like borderline hood neighborhood when I was little, so I was always around and I knew what was up, more so than like the other kids that went to my school. I would like go across town to an art school. It's called Waldorf School. It's like a hippie, it's an alternative school.
Like private school?
Yeah, it's an alternative private school, but it's not like a rich kid school.
Yeah,
it's more just,
it's just like hippie parents send their kids there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And cool like parents. Rich parents, yeah. Also.
So how, what was the like academics like there, or what
it was awesome. It was like, so it's not broken up into like English, math, whatever. It's like main lesson, and you learn one thing. Like, we're gonna learn Gilgamesh for 2 months, and you just learn that for half the day. Then the other half the day is PE, Spanish, music, woodshop, like elective type classes. So yeah, you kind of learn one thing at a time. They don't teach you how to read till you're like in third grade. They
what?
Focus on all
that
kinds of other, yeah, like, yeah. I know how to knit with 5 needles. I could like knit
it's
you a
hat. It's funny that you just said that, because I was, as you were saying, like, you know, woodshop, I was going to go knitting just as a joke. And then
knitting,
you're like,
yeah.
I know how to knit.
Knitting, crocheting, cross-stitching.
You know, making essential oils.
And like, yeah, you, shit like that. And they, you celebrate, I guess every school celebrates most holidays, but you kind of go in depth.
Yeah,
with like celebrating all kinds of cultures, and then everyone sings, everyone plays. So even as a little kid, I mean, I know they have to do that in public school also.
Well, not necessarily.
I went to public school also.
We have music class, but I mean, you don't necessarily have to learn how to play. You don't, you know, unless you really seek out playing instruments at a public school, I don't think you really get a chance to. So you guys kind of had instruments.
Yeah,
put in your hands.
this was like, you know, everyone. Like, everyone has to play recorder and pick a second instrument that they're going to learn. Everyone has to do recorder.
I played recorder,
course.
Yeah. It was lit. I mean, yeah. I still know fucking hot cross buns like a motherfucker.
Yeah. So. But yeah, so that school was really, like, looking back, I only went there until I was 10.
Yeah.
But it was just so cool, because also it was kindergarten through eighth grade, so I was around older kids a lot,
okay,
who were like cool, like San Francisco older kids in the 90s.
Yeah.
And they had a huge impact on, like, that's the first kids that brought me, you know, Wu-Tang, East Coast hip hop, yeah. And then obviously like Bay Area shit, and even like stuff from down here, like AC Alone. I used to rock with all that stuff when I was like 11.
Yeah. Oh, so Kev that we were talking about earlier, he used to record. Like, he was.
What's AC Alone from?
Freestyle Fellowship.
Yeah, I had that on tape.
Like, Kev used to produce a lot of their records.
Really? Yeah, so it was like, I was exposed to all that so early.
Yeah.
And I don't even. So I never thought like that I had to seek that out. I was just always kind of took it like, that's where I come from. My mom, even like her friends listened to hip hop music and were into that too. So it was in the house, even that was in the house too. My mom was essentially like what I am now.
Yeah.
You know, she was like a hip young person with a kid that would take me all around San Francisco. And so I just absorbed all of that, you know, from the time I was like 6 months old. And,
right.
You know, anytime there was like a party that it'd be acceptable. Like, if you go to a party now and I invite you, you know, to, I'm having a barbecue and you had a 2-year-old, it's like, it's all love. Bring the 2-year-old, he's going to run out over here. Someone's going to be smoking over here.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's kind of, I was raised.
I mean, shit, my 2-year-old nephew was like knowing club going up on a Tuesday and sing along with it. So 2-year-olds are hipper than we imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was sort of like that. And I think that was cool, because it made me not afraid to put myself out there. And so if you're going back to being like 13, and that's when I started, I got involved in this thing called Youth Speaks. It was like a teen poetry slam back when that was a thing.
Oh, sick.
That was cool.
You know George Watsky? Did you grow up with him at all?
No.
He was like a big he was
spoken word.
Yeah, spoken word poet
in San Francisco.
Yeah, in San Fran.
I kind of dropped out of it. It was really only I wanted to only play basketball.
Yeah.
So, but for right after my dad passed away, I was like fueled, and I would go, and I had my one little poem I had, and it was like a powerful person in my presence, peering in my poetry presence, throwing
popping peace,
yeah,
profusely.
Popping all that, and yeah. I went to the first one. I was the youngest contestant. And I just like really shut that shit down. That was like the best performance I've ever given. They were going crazy.
Alliteration is amazing.
Yeah. And they were, and they obviously cut me slack because I was 13, but even I got like leaps and bounds better just going and watching and just copying and learning how to express myself. So that kind of happened. And then I had that, and like just, I really only participated for 2 years, but I did well. And just the response that I got, I'd always wanted to be in front of people and do something, but I wasn't good at anything. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like a good singer or like a performer really at all. But just like pouring myself out there, that like the crowd, like the energy was so thick, and it just was so inspiring that was always in the back of my head. I think like if I write how I really feel down and just put it out there for people, that's something. And
so you're like 13, 14 at that time, and then but when do you find out that you can sing?
So then singing,
because I have a funny story about singing too. Like listening to your records, I was like, these are dope, and like you can tell he's a great ear for pop hooks and a good but like they all use auto-tune, but for style, you know what I mean? And that's what I assumed. But and so I went like, I'm like talking to Michelle, and I'm like, hey, this is like an awkward question, but can he like actually sing in real life? Because if he performs, like, we're not going to like really keep the auto-tune on. She's like, oh yeah, he just does that for style. Like he can sing his ass off. And I'm like, all right, cool. But it's just funny how like in the modern times, that's like a touchy question. Like, cause there are some singers that really can't.
No, but to be perfectly honest, like I can sing. I mean, I'll sing for you guys, but I'm not like, I wasn't born like gifted with a crazy singing voice.
You ain't like Mariah Carey or something.
But even even just that. Like my technique is poor. A lot of shit. I started rapping. Yeah. You know, so I started rapping like over a band, but I know how to construct the melody.
Right.
And I have a good ear. And you know, singing, it's like there's so many dope singers. If you go down to any karaoke on Tuesday night or whatever the fuck in Los Angeles, you're gonna hear people that
can sing.
Voice-wise, could probably sing circles around me, but they can't access like who they really are with their voice, and that's what's always, that's the kind of voices that I've been attracted to listening to. That's what I go for, and singing just happened because every time we got to the hook, that's when I really was like, I always knew what to do in the hook, and just in terms of like that was like listening growing up, really, while everyone else was listening to Mac Dre, and I was listening to, you know,
James Taylor
or Stevie Wonder mostly at that time.
Okay, yeah.
Inner Visions, just any kind of old soul melodies, like those are the melodies that stick to this day, you know, and in pop music. And those and the Beatles also, you know, those set the foundation for any good song still. And so I have that on deck, you know. A lot of people, a lot of young writers out there, rappers, whatever, they don't have like all that musical history, and they haven't really explored that, I think, but I've gotten to do that. And that's also a cool thing about being around for a while, is like I've gotten to see, you know, a few of these different waves that have come across, and like, oh, this is hot for a year or two or even three or whatever, but the ones that stay are always the ones that understand like classic melody. And that's like, even in his own way, Future is kind of, you know, even though his melodies, like when he wants to put a melody on some shit, he'll put a melody on some shit. When he wants it to be hard, it'll be hard. Same thing with Drake. Even Kendrick, you know, just understanding pocket and melody is everything if you're a vocalist.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I've studied.
So did you start developing that in high school then? Like when you say you started rapping, like I'm sure that we probably started the same way, where it's like you start memorizing your songs and then, or memorizing like your favorite rap songs, and then all your friends go like, "Oh, yo, Mark can fucking say this whole rap, like, you know, and recite it without even listening to the song," shit like that.
Yeah.
And then you become the kid that knows how to rap, and so then you start making your own raps or what?
Yeah, but actually, I was embarrassed, like, to rap.
Yeah.
When, because for me, like, I had, you know, I had like real hood friends and shit, and I just didn't feel comfortable being like the white kid that rapped ever. I thought that was corny. So
right.
To me, I was like, if I want to do music, I have to like respect. This is in like 2003. This is before like white people had overrun hip hop. And
yeah, it all kind of changed in 99. I feel like with Eminem, that
it
was
did.
Like,
yeah, that was big. But even that, I was like, that's not cool, man.
Yeah.
I don't even want to hear white people rap. That's how I kind of felt. Like,
yeah,
that's for them. That's for black people. Like, that's their culture. And that's, like, my friends, black and white. I don't know. Then I don't know. I didn't feel right being, like, the white kid that did that. Bo Rat, he was great at that. Like,
you were early to not being a cultural appropriator.
Yeah. I'm always really sensitive about that. I've always been sensitive about that. So I didn't want to do that. So I hid music from all my friends. I didn't tell anybody. I joined a rock band. So everyone was super like, what? You're in a rock band? Like, you don't even listen to rock music.
Yeah.
You don't even know. And it's true. I hadn't even listened to any music with distorted guitar until junior year of high school. And I joined a band because I wanted to do that secretly.
And what were you doing in the band? Guitar, singing?
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
No. Like, what was your role?
I was a singer.
You were the singer.
But it was more, they had approached me. And these were kids that like I didn't even really know in high school.
Yeah.
But they were like, you know how you did? I had did a slam poem in class. And they're like, you know that poem that you did? Like, can you just do that while we play? Because we don't have a singer.
Yeah.
And whatever. And I was like, yeah, let's try it. And then I had like certain go-to rock songs that I thought like, this is what it is, and they were like, what, the really big Soundgarden, Black Hole Sun?
Yeah.
So I had like that song and like a few Incubus songs and Red Hot Chili Pepper songs I knew I could sing.
Yeah.
So then I got kind of comfortable
doing those,
and we would like cover those, and then The Roots. And like Black Thought, you know, like on Do You Want More, he was like really melodic. And there was so much melody in all his rap, so I knew all that shit. And then like, this is, you know, Mos Def, Talib Kweli, like people started coming out where like hip hop and melody was
brown skin lady.
Yeah.
You know, like Black Star and shit.
Yeah, exactly. And so we would play like a lot of that kind of like fusion neo soul hip hop stuff.
Yeah.
And then I just got more comfortable with singing. But no one thought I was a good singer, and I wasn't like the star of my band in high school or anything like that. Like the guitar player. He was like the guy.
Really?
And I was just kind of there. But
why?
I loved, he
why,
was,
why
cause
was
he has, and still to this day, he's in San Francisco now, but he's just was an amazing musical talent. And I was just kind of, I was just happy to be part of it. And I was playing basketball and that was my thing. And I didn't do music to be cool. It wasn't like for the girls or anything. And I didn't even know that was going to be a part of anything.
Yeah, the freak dancing was for the girls, not the songwriting.
You know? Yeah, so it was just kind of, I was happy to be there and be part of music and have like a place I could go. We would rehearse. We had the garage. We had the whole setup.
Sick.
And then after about a year and a half, I started to realize like, actually, this could be like cool. And then I started to merge my worlds. And now we had started to have concerts and win all kinds of Battle of the Bands. And we sort of like established ourselves as like the high school, the little high school band.
You guys were the high school band. And then
in my high school,
get asked to like play bar mitzvahs and shit or what?
I don't think we ever did a bar mitzvah, but
proms?
We played on the lawn in high school, and we did like the Battle of the Bands things, and we won some studio time. And this is back in the day when you had to win studio time.
Yeah, studio time meant something.
Yeah. So like we had to rehearse. We went and knocked out our songs, and I loved all of that.
Yeah.
And I loved it. Looking back, it was really cool because I just loved doing it. It's one thing in my life that I can say it was never any, I had no aspiration. I just liked doing it.
Yeah.
And I loved being with my friends. And then when I started to see the drummer of my band, his name was Ben, he was more like, yo, if we do this, this, and this, then we'll get to studio time. If we save up this amount of money, there's this place we can go. And then I started to see that, and I was like, I'm better at relating to the world than you. I should be out there being business minded with it also. And so then I kind of like took hold and that's when I was in college, I was like, I could really do this, and then fully went for it. And but you know, it took me a long time to figure it out. But
so when you're in high school, is it like what percentage is basketball, what percentage is band, and what percentage is like academic shit? Like, what were you known as more, or just like the all around dude? You know what I mean?
I mean, I was a cool kid. Basketball was everything. Yeah. Basketball was everything. No one even knew I did music until senior year of high school.
Oh, okay.
So my junior year I was in the band, but I didn't tell anyone.
You weren't putting it out there.
I didn't tell anyone. Yeah. And then I let my girlfriend hear a tape, and she was like, oh my God, Mark, you're actually good. You have to you have to do this. And I had no idea.
She's like, you're going to get so much freak dancing tonight.
Yeah. So I just kind of went for
it. Wait, so you had a girl, but you weren't like fucking secretly singing her Incubus songs to get it going?
No, and I never did any shit like that.
Well, that's good. At least you're not a cornball then.
I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, because of that.
In the late 90s, early 2000s, those were the worst people, or the dudes that like bring a guitar to the party and start trying to sing Incubus songs. It's like, man, fuck you.
Yeah. No, I was not. I didn't start out like that, but yeah. I definitely turned. I had a phase of that. But that was after.
That's funny.
But I will say, to me and Matt's credit, Matt was like the very best fret guitar player in the history of America. Yeah. And he can still play. If you're an Incubus fan, he can play every single Mike Isinger solo on an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
He's like, he can do anything on a guitar. So I always felt comfortable being in any setting, because it's like, you guys need to hear. Like, you'll never sit in a room with someone as good as this kid who can play this good. And it really... And that is actually how we got popping, and we ended up when we were on that like sort of
frat
little frat circuit. We played at Chapman, and one of the kids who I had known from before, his dad was from the Talking Heads, Jerry Harrison.
Oh shit!
And he was a producer, and he's like, "You guys are actually tight." Like we would go play at his house, and the parties would get crashed, and it would be crazy. He was like, "You should go if you have any songs, you know, I'll send them to my dad." So I met with him, and we ended up, we just got serious. Like, I had been in L.A. for 2 or 3 years, like, just smoking weed, not doing anything.
Yeah, well, wait, hold on. Let's not skip too far ahead, then. Sorry. Let's go back to this, because this sounds like the lead into the pathway, I guess. But so after high school, you decided you're going to go to Santa Cruz for a year, right?
Yeah.
And what did you think you were going to do? Like, before you started chasing the dream, what did you think was the dream?
That was weird. I don't know. That's the only time in my life I can say I didn't know what I was doing. I was sort of in shock. I had also, not to get all depressive
and be
a downer, but I also had like this traumatic head injury in high school.
Well, like a TBI? Brain injury?
Yeah.
So I
had ruptured veins behind my right eye in my brain. And
how?
Like I got hit in the head, not in like a violent way. Yeah. I mean, a violent act, but not. I mean, not like a. Wasn't like a fight or anything.
Yeah, you didn't get hit with the baseball.
No, I was playing basketball.
Oh, okay.
And then it had like triggered something in my brain. So for 6 months, and this is after you know my dad had passed away. My whole community was a small high school community.
Yeah,
everyone knew like Mark's dad passed away, and my dad was like a strong member of the community too. And so everyone had kind of been with me through all that, and then this happened to me. So by the middle of junior year, after I had fully come out of that, it was like 6 months of like I wasn't in school. They didn't know what was wrong with me.
Did you go into like a coma for a second?
No, I didn't go into a coma, but I fully had to have brain surgery.
Oh.
But I played basketball after it. It was really weird, but there was like a month period where they're like, we don't know what's in your brain.
Yeah.
Like, it's bad.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, you know, and I have so many women in my family. They're all women.
Yeah.
And they're all in the hospital. And it was, shout out to women everywhere. I love them all. But they're more emotional. And it was just so much to deal with that I kind of, that was just another thing. And just like my dad, which had happened like 3 years prior.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually when music really kicked up, was because after that, it was like this basketball shit is... Like, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to play. And my kind of, like, high school community sort of let me off the hook. After junior year, it was like, when I went to sign up for classes senior, I was like, I'm not taking math. They're like, you don't have to take math, Mark. You don't have to do shit. Just, like, don't...
Like, just get better.
Yeah, like, don't do anything crazy and, like, don't turn into a psycho your senior year and just be smooth. And I was always smooth. I never got, like, terrible grades and I was, you know, not good enough in most classes. So I really, that was great. Like, yeah. I had a really supportive community that even supported, like, when I started doing music and showing people, like, trying to help me out. And people, because they had known in where I come, you know, where I come from, where I went to high school, at least, is a nice place. And people, it's not, like, that many kids that have to go through losing a parent, all that type of shit.
So brain people, injury and
yeah,
all
and all that. So people kind of had.
They looked out for you.
People looked out for me. And
so you go to Santa Cruz just kind of like because that's what you're supposed to do. You're just supposed to go to college, right?
Yeah, I was like, this is the only college I got into that was good. And I always had a, like, I didn't want to go to San Diego State because I felt like that was, I was too smart for that or something, even though I wasn't. But
damn, you just called San Diego State way the fuck out.
Well, it was easier to get into, I mean. I always had a
sense. Oh, so you got accepted there too or something?
Yeah. Was like between, I was like, I want to go to a UC school. Like, that's better than a state school. But I have plenty of friends. My roommate went to San Diego State. He's smarter than me. So it's not a knock on a state school or whatever. But I had, you know, I had the opportunity to go financially. So I was like, fuck it, I'm going to go to Santa Cruz and see what happens. But Santa Cruz is a really cool place, actually. Like, I would love to go back there now and go to college.
Yeah.
But at the time, it just I just smoked pot just too, all day. And I was in the hippiest of hippie.
Right.
It's called Kresge.
Yeah.
In Santa Cruz. And I was like, you know, the kid with the, I was like a wigger and with all the hippies.
Yeah.
So I was really out of place.
Oh, shit.
But I love that.
Yeah.
That was cool.
You're and like, man, shit, I might just grow dreads this year.
Yeah, no, I can never do that. But they taught me a lot. I learned a lot about music. Like, that's when I learned about...
Fish?
No. Oh. They're like, they would not like Fish where I was.
Really?
They were like, The Clash.
Oh, okay,
The Ramones.
Yeah.
Like...
Had you picked up a guitar at this point already?
No.
Okay.
So still no. I still don't play guitar, you'll see. Like, I know like six chords and I just get down.
I seen you outside strumming on it and I was like, oh, cool, he plays guitar. Here we go.
Not really.
Yeah.
Just enough to like write and make my own songs.
Just enough to look pretty on camera for the ladies.
Yeah, sure. Something like that. But yeah, it was just a good, like, that was a good time. I was really like nice to people in that during that year, and I made some of my best connections that hold to this day. And, you know, like the way I've been able to navigate LA and the music industry has a lot to do with the relationships I made.
So did
in
the
Santa
band?
Cruz.
Did the band guys stick with you? Like, were you still some of the guys from the band at Santa Cruz? Were you guys still playing, or like how does it jump from like here I am in college smoking weed and chilling to fuck it, I'm gonna move to LA and make this shit for real?
So this the guitar player.
Matt,
he was in Washington State at University of Washington, and I was calling him like, I don't know, man, like, I don't like college, I just want to go to LA. We knew this one producer that we thought like he would do something, he would like change our life. And Matt was like, yeah, I play guitar all day, I don't do anything but play guitar up here. I'm not. He was in a frat, but he wasn't really into it either. So we both
did. You go? Did you join a frat too?
No, there's no frats at Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay. Just,
so we both decided like we'll leave and move to LA, and we just did it. And we didn't really.
Where'd you guys move to?
Lancashire Boulevard, Lancashire and Victory.
Okay.
This is in like 2005.
Uh huh.
So this is a really long time ago, and it was fucked up out there at the time. It was like nasty. I lived with all like drug addicts and psychos, and it was cool. It was you know, good, like,
yeah,
it was like, whoa,
it was like real life.
It was like real life all of a sudden, coming from, you know, something much cushier. Yeah. Yeah, and like there was like six of us in the two bedroom smoking blunts. Then I just started collecting people to play music with, because this is still like we were on our band shit. So like, if you could play, we had an awesome drummer. He was from Stockton, this dreaded kid named Pure Rick.
Shout out Stockton. Shout out Brian Awkward's Peoples.
I know Awkward's. Yeah. I know of him.
Yeah, there you go.
So it was just that whole time period was so fun. That was a time when we would like, I worked on a moving truck 3 days a week, and I would make bread. Like,
really?
Yeah. The
tips
moving truck, yeah. It's like $120 in cash, you know, after the thing. And sometimes I would work, like, I worked 36 straight hours one time and made like $1,200. My rent was probably like $280 or something.
Wow, that's cheap. Because you were living with six other dudes.
Yeah. And because, you know, I could always hit my mom and be like, Mom, I need $100. Mm-hmm. She was always cool. Like, mm-hmm. I was never tripping on money.
She was supportive of the dream.
Yeah, all the way supportive. And I was cheap. You know, I wasn't going to school anymore. Right. So no one had to, like, worry about paying for my education.
Uh-huh. So do you guys start playing out around L.A.?
So, opening gigs, we did
Sean Healy shows?
First, we did the open mic circuit. And Sean Healy, we were never accepted by any music community, period.
Same. Yeah.
Because we were so weird.
Yeah.
Because I didn't want to be like a rapper and part of hip hop, and I didn't know about rock shit really. It was just, our music was, looking back, it was the strangest shit. It was like me trying to be like on my Poetry Slam lyrics, but with sometimes like really poppy sounding shit,
uh-huh.
and with like a really intricate, yeah. Incubus guitar style.
Like math rock with fucking Poetry Sorta. Slam or something.
Yeah. Like it was, I don't know if it was good.
Yeah, right.
But it was different.
Do you have any of those old tapes laying around?
Yeah.
You ever listen to them and be like, what the fuck?
We did in the car the other day. I think they're tight, but
yeah.
I don't know if Josh, what he thought, but when we would do the open mic shit, we would kill every time. And so we would go, there was this place called Highland Grounds that was like a big open mic. And that's where all the John Mayers were at and all the like Jason Mraz and that type of shit that we were talking about that's not cool.
Yeah.
You know, in that setting that makes you like want, it's like grades against you sort of. And I think we were refreshing in that scene because I can't sing as good as that blonde kid with the guitar.
But
we had a thing. So we'd always get invited back and like, you should play a show here. And then we started doing the colleges and getting, you know, every one of my friends was in college at the time, like around California somewhere. So we would go to the frat parties and then we started to just had like a little moving caravan around me. And it was really a scene and it was fucking cool. Like, I had really talented people around me, and then I started pick up musicians from LA, and we'd play in my house 8 hours a day. Like, music would be banging in my house. I got evicted. The apartment caught on fire.
Oh, shit.
We would just, like, fry chicken and smoke blunts all day. The hood would come out and fuck with us, too. Like, I made all these friends with these, like, Brims, Blood, gangsters in Echo Park, and they would drive all the way out to the valley because the vibes were so strong. And they'd be like, man, I just like coming fucking with y'all. And like, they would freestyle, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was just like really good energy around us and really musical. The guy who lived underneath us, he was a public finance consultant, like in the huge Citibank building in downtown LA. He was like 27, but he played djembe.
Oh, yeah.
He's a West African. I mean, he's from here, but his parents are West African. And every day he would get home from work, come right upstairs, we would pass him the blunt, he would start playing drums and like join the circle, and it like led him all the way join my band, quit his job.
Oh shit.
And he was 28 and I was 18, you know. Like the bass player, he was a young professional, he was 26, he was in advertising, he started to come around, he was nasty on the bass. He quit his job.
So people believed in you.
Yeah, so people just were around, they believed in us, and we took it to the house the first try. Like we kind of cultivated a little fan base. It wasn't big, but it was like hot girls.
What was the group name?
It was called 2 AM Club.
Okay.
And we got a record deal when I was like 23.
Yeah, so how does that happen? Because here's the thing is that I don't know. This is the most I've ever learned about you, obviously. Like, I didn't do a lot of research. So, but I kind of assume.
Thanks a lot, man.
No, I don't research anyone, so it makes the conversations go better. Jerk.
Right.
But what was I gonna say? Oh, I did kind of figure that you're probably like tied into the industry somehow, like maybe like songwriting with people and shit like that. And so, yeah, how does your first soiree into the industry happen?
So the first soiree was, we got with Jerry Harrison and we made three songs, and these are like 2008. This is 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
And we made like three or four songs. I wrote a song called Worry About You. And we had a song called Flashing Room and a song called Let Me Down Easy. And they were just like pop, pop, but they were cool. And we had a rapper in the group too, who was extremely fucking good.
What was his name?
His name's Tyler Cordy. He would have served anyone in the Bay, in the white boy battle rap community for sure. He was from Seattle and he was like a heavy hip hop kid at first, but he kind of had the same thing as me. Like, he wasn't with the appropriation thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he wanted to be more part of like a pop thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this all was going on, and this was brewing into like a boy band, but I had no idea because that was the farthest thing from how I viewed myself ever. Because like I said, like I never did music for the girls. They didn't like me for that. It was nothing. That kind of shit didn't occur to me that I was like turning myself into a boy band. And something happened where like we were doing funky like Chili Peppers music and we were dressed like like terribly, like in baggy cargo shorts and shit like that.
Yeah,
that was a weird time, right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
2000 like 6 and 7
yeah,
like
terrible.
No one yeah it was like
Abercrombie and Fitch shit
yeah kinda. Like if you could yeah sort something in there
like the bag and, yeah I know what you're talking about. Like baggy cargo shorts
yeah we
terrible.
Met we met this guy who was like, you guys write good songs. We met Jerry and he was like, you guys write good songs, like pop songs, you need to like do that. But you need to like change your image. And I had never even thought about image also.
Right.
So it was like,
that's a big difference between like the underground indie scene and then when you get tied into the labels. It's like,
but this wasn't even label, like underground kids. We weren't underground kids either.
Yeah.
We were like, we were just in this weird, just this weird thing that existed. Like underground kids know what they're doing.
Right.
They're like, they define themselves by how they dress.
Right.
But we're like the kids, like I was a little basketball kid.
Yeah.
You know, I had,
you had
been used to
Adidas
getting shined
on and shit.
Yeah, kind of. I was more like that.
Yeah.
Like if that would be if I was touching some money, I was going to like the Nike store and getting something like that.
Right.
So
he tells you guys got to touch your.
So
image
he's
up.
Like, yeah. So I'm like, okay. So I just went. We all went for it and like put the skinny jeans on and the V-neck and the blazer, and then it just like worked.
Whoa,
and then
V-neck and blazer. That was a very 2006 thing right there.
Yeah. That's terrible. I'm ashamed of that. But
was it like a violet blazer?
No, but I would have done that.
What color was the blazer?
Black, for sure.
Okay.
But we did all that shit, and then we kind of, we were like a more advanced boy band where everyone in my band
could play.
Could really play, though.
Yeah.
Like, and they still, we're not together, obviously, anymore. All that fell apart, but everyone was really good at their craft and super dedicated, and all that shit fucked us up. And the fact that there was six of us.
The image stuff or what? What do you mean?
Yeah, kind of, because it started to be like, we sort of just wanted to write. We got into that thing like, we need hits, you know?
And so you guys set your image up and then you get signed. Who signs you?
We started to do this thing that doesn't really exist anymore called showcasing.
Oh, yeah.
Where these labels fly you out to New York City.
Right.
This is like in 2010.
And then you play small little shows.
Not even, like that. And like, just the label comes and like,
right.
Andre Harrell's like sitting in a armchair right in front of me.
Yeah.
And
I feel like they used to do that at the Viper Room a lot.
And like we would pack out this place called the Derby is what it was called. And we had a residency there. It was called the Tiny Porno Residency.
Okay.
Advanced name. So we were advanced in like cool ways, but no one, they just saw a boy band. But we packed that shit out and the label started coming and seeing that. And that we started to get like 300 or 400 people to like shows consistently, only in LA, and we had never really toured much or anything. And when people started to see, when they heard the songs, when the labels heard the songs, you know, we met a lawyer who like would send the shit out to A&Rs or whatever. The songs got passed around, then all of a sudden, like I had never been to New York City. I was like in there going wilding out in the hotels and having fun and being a kid. And partying and doing all these showcases, and we ended up getting like 6 offers. It was like a bidding war for 2AM Club, and we ended up signing with RCA, and we put out our, you know, we went through all that, and then we put out our debut album. We had a song on the top 40 that was Worry About You, and we were touring.
Sure.
We were out there like, we're still, our lane was so confusing because we had a rapper, we were all white, we looked like a boy band. But the vocalist, that's me, had a soulful voice. The lyrics were like deep at times. It was really confusing for everybody.
And what year was the top 40 hit?
2010.
No shit.
Yeah.
Would I recognize it if I heard it?
It wasn't in Cali.
Uh-huh.
But the week that it broke top 40, our entire radio staff got fired.
Oh.
And moved to Warner. So it was like a lot of shit like
moved to Warner?
Yeah.
Did you know Dave Dyer?
Yeah, that was him.
Get the fuck out. Hey, that's my dude.
That's your dude.
Yeah, he's such a good guy.
Ask him about 2AM Club. He'll tell you. Like,
no shit.
We were raw.
Dude, Warren, like his whole clique that moved over to Warner, they're like the fucking radio G's, dog. They kill it with radio promo.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out Dave Dyer. That's crazy. So he was at RCA and pushing that record, and then they all get fired. Because that's what happens in the industry.
It's not
like,
that they got
not fired.
Someone came in,
clean
house. The guy who came in, he was like, I don't know if I fuck with 2AM Club.
Right.
He fucked with this other band, Hot Show Ray.
Yeah.
you know, and they had this, they had a hit with him, and then we were just kind of stuck in the right. middle.
And that's what happens is like one staff hires you, and then they play musical chairs within the industry and jump to another label, and then you get lost in the shuffle because they can't bring you with you because you're under contract.
Exactly.
Right.
So that's what happened. And then, but really everyone in my band had a slight mental disorder, seriously, and still probably does, including myself. And it was just too many people, and everyone was good, and everyone wanted to write and do everything and have input on everything. And it got, no one would listen to me. No one would really listen to anybody. And so we were just like, we didn't have a leader. Uh-huh. I wasn't ready to be a leader at that time either. I was just trying to figure out.
And you were like one of the younger guys in the band too, right? Or no?
Well, we were all this. I was actually the youngest member of the band. There was only, by the time we had gotten signed and everything, we had one, our bass player was older.
Yeah.
By a few years, but everyone else was within like right. a 1 or 2 year okay. range. But it was just, we didn't fit into anything. And to a lot, and to a certain extent, I still don't. And I look back and I realize like it was actually me. If I had really just played the role, it probably would have been easier, but I've never been willing to do that. You know, I can only be myself.
Right.
To the point where I don't give a fuck. Like if it ruins my whole, if I go down swinging for myself, I'm fine with that. And even now, but at least when you're by yourself, when you're on your own, especially with the way music is now, it's like I feel way more comfortable with myself and I know what type of music I can make and where I fit in now. And at that time, I just hadn't had enough experience.
So you don't think you had like found your voice yet, really?
I hadn't found my voice. And yeah. if I was trying to find my voice, that was not the right context to do it, yeah, because yeah. it was like we're writing a smash and it's yeah. like big huge synth lines and hooks going through everything, and right. I more so needed to, like, the way that I got out of it was by going all the way back to like boom bap, like 90s hip hop, and yeah. just rapping again. So really? Like when I would be home away from my band, I would just start recording raps, like fucking 64 bars, bang bang, and
yeah.
and just going and like getting back in touch with the Bay Area music scene.
Yeah,
the band thing was amazing, and it taught me everything I know about music and song structure and how to do all that.
Just real quick, did you like make a call, or did it just fizzle away? Like did you call and be like, hey guys, I'm out?
I emailed, but that was only like a year ago.
Oh really? So it kind of,
like, we held on, like we made a whole second album that never came out.
Really?
Yeah.
And but were you happy during that process?
I mean, it was fun because the label rented us a huge house up in the hills.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to live that life. Like,
so we were still with RCA?
We were still with RCA. But then they weren't going in for us. We had a song with Big Sean called Mary that was a smash. If you go listen to it, you'd be like, if I put it on right now, it'd be a smash today.
Mm-hmm.
But the label couldn't get Big Sean behind it. Even though we had toured with him and we knew him, but I don't know. It's all love. Like, I don't have any, like, yeah. I wish he would have co-signed the song and really rocked with it because it was a good song, but he didn't.
Yeah.
And he was at that phase too. I'm sure he was like, he was going kind of pop. That's when he had first put out his first like single, and he was coming from like underground hip hop right. shit. I think he was so like, I don't know if I can rock with these white boys, right. like with this whole image, this whole thing, like, I don't know if he thought that was the look for him at the time.
Wait, what year was that that got made?
This is like 2013.
Oh, wow. So this is like real fresh then.
Yeah, this is 12 maybe? 2012. No, it could be 13. I don't know. But anyway, so he did that, and then the song got leaked. And then he was pissed. You know, he tweeted like, get the business right or some shit. And
how'd you guys end up on tour with him?
That was before, because we toured everywhere with Mike Posner. That was like our tour buddy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was super popping at the time. And him and Big Sean were always touring together. So everyone in the industry knows 2AM Club. Right. If you're an A&R, like, you probably at one point thought 2AM Club was a pretty solid band.
Was next up or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so, so I've kind of grown up in the industry in a way. So I know about this shit. You know, I know about the music business. And so when I got back, when the band started to fizzle was when people didn't want to hang out anymore. That's when you know it's bad. Like when cats just don't really want to get together and cats start staying at home longer than they're supposed to. I'm going to spend an extra week in wherever I'm at. And then for me, luckily, my friends that I had made from the Bay Area who had moved to LA, straight from the Bay to LA, who were like a few years younger, they were starting to pop off. And that was like Bobby Brackens and Nick Knack, and they were doing like the producing writing thing more so. So I got back here And I didn't know what to do. I knew my band was fizzling out and it wasn't going anywhere, but I didn't have my own solo career carved out at all. But I was really good friends with this kid, Nick Knack, producer, and he's like, bro. So I would start working with him, doing weird songs, and he's like, yo, I got Sean Kingston at the house right now. He's cutting one of your songs. So I go over to the house, Sean Kingston's there, and then we work on this song, Beat It. This was like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that song?
Yeah, vaguely.
Beat it.
I feel like Sean Kingston is like still pretty low-key influential in the industry, huh? Or something. Yeah. Like, it seems like he has his hands in a lot of shit.
He's a smart motherfucker.
Right.
And he's talented. You know, I could say a lot of shit about him, but I mean, I wasn't that big part of Beat It. I was just kind of there. Yeah. And I was like, oh, so like songwriting.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm going to do. And right. That was like something that I was really comfortable. Like, give me a beat and give me like an hour and I'll cook something up.
So did you get out of the deal with the band? Like,
no, so at this time we're still in the band. I'm still like flying to do dry shows at like colleges that still want to pay us, like cash us out, whatever, yeah. like 7,500, 10 yeah. racks or something. Like yeah. we'll go fly and play the show. Cause we did have fans, you know, and we had, you know, videos with a million plus plays and all that type of shit. So we were like somewhat relevant still. But we all knew, because we just didn't want to do music together anymore.
You just weren't vibing with each other.
That was the bottom line. We yeah. just didn't want to do it together. So at that point, yeah, I was trying to figure it out, and I just started writing. And then I met this girl, Pia Mia. She's turning into a superstar.
You guys just had something on like Fader or something together, right?
Well, she jumped on one of my songs, but she has a top 40 song now. It's called Do It Again.
Yeah. Oh, and she samples that J-Boog.
Yeah, that's the homie.
Or like flipped the J-Boog shit. Yeah.
So we met her when she was 16.
Yeah.
And Nima, who owns a Pink Dolphin clothing company, he had heard her. She was modeling for a lookbook for Pink Dolphin. And he was like, yo, there's this girl. I heard her sing. Like, I heard she's a really dope singer. I'm going to bring her by the studio. Nick had just produced half of Sean Kingston's album, so he's like starting to really heat up. I had got like a little small percentage on Beat It, and I had on another song called Shot to Love with 2 Chainz on it, and we were in the studio with Chris Brown and shit, so I was like, there's something over here. So the band thing is fizzling, but I got this writing thing, this is cool, and I like it, and I love Nick Knack's a superstar producer, genius. So like being around him, I never was around someone that I really like, I saw in that light to that extent as him.
So are you guys like a writing production team now?
We're roommates now.
Roommates.
Yeah.
Well, because here's the thing that I talked about this briefly on a podcast I did a couple weeks ago with this gal Penny, but like there's like this whole culture in the industry that a lot of like outside kids who kids that listen to music don't know about this, but there are just like teams around that like there's a dude that produces and maybe he has a couple songwriters that they sit there and knock out demos all day and then shop them to people.
Yeah,
are you guys kind
of
doing that now?
Well, that's what we were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So we, but really Pia,
when you were in 2 a.m. Club, were you guys having to do that where they're like flying you out to meet with various producers all the time?
Well,
and
that's
shit?
The other thing that fucked it up.
Yeah.
We were capable of doing everything
by yourselves,
but
right.
We stopped. We splintered off. And me and the other vocalists, we would go work with all these producers, hit makers, and the rest of the band was like, you guys suck for that. That's really where we killed it.
Right.
Was the label being like, you should go work with this producer instead of making us a real band.
Right.
And we had always been a real band. And our live show was always better than our records because our live show had integrity.
Yeah.
And no one could fuck with our live show. The haters that hated us, when they saw us live, they were like, whoa, you guys are like the killers. Like right, you guys are a real fucking band.
Right.
What are you doing?
Right.
Like, why haven't you just got in a room and recorded your shit, how you play it, and done it?
Right.
You didn't even need all the auto-tune and all that type of, you know, but we wanted to be pop. So that's kind of is what killed 2AM Club, probably. It was that we splintered off and just stopped being a band when that was our actual strong suit, was musicianship and songwriting, but...
So just within the last couple of years, you start basically becoming your own production team with Nick?
Me and Nick started cooking all the time.
Yeah.
And then that was happening. I was like, okay, this is really tight. I'm going to see like where this can take me. But it wasn't the best thing that was happening was like people, I was singing Pia's demos and like big, you know, the big shots were coming through for Pia and Pia's popping. She has a million Instagram followers at the time. Like she's growing. And she's labels are coming through and they're like, oh, who's singing all this shit? And it's always me. And I'm always in the corner tucked off.
Right.
Because it's not my operation anymore. I'm totally fine to like take a back seat to Nick.
You're good with like the egos in check and you don't even care about the fucking credit. Like, it's just what, just like, chilling. Get it done. Like, get it done.
Yeah, I'm just having fun, really. Yeah. Like, I'm glad that I like just landed on my feet somewhere where like, professional, awesome, high-level shit is getting cooked up. Because that's where I want to be, is around talent.
Right.
And there I'm living with the best producer in rap music, period, in my opinion.
Right.
So he's right there. And then, but then what happened was Nick made Loyal. And I had no part in Loyal. And then that took him, like, you know, all the way, all of a sudden, he made the biggest song in the country.
Oh, wow.
So, and he made that, I'm sitting right there, like, in the bedroom. And then that kind of got me like,
how does that song get? He made the beat for it, and then did he write it too, or like what?
Nah, Ty wrote it with Bobby Brackens, and sent through. That's, you know, my bro.
Yeah,
sent through the acapella, and it was on like another Knick Knack beat.
Yeah,
and then Nick like kind of like on a like a demo beat sort of that he had done, and then he cooked up the smash, you know, around it, and I kind of also saw like maybe even though I am doing somewhat good like writing. I still, my pocket, like my perfect lane pocket isn't writing, you know, R and bass, like Power 106 music. Like I can do it, but it's not like it's working out for Nick and these cats better than it is for me. I don't really have, I haven't wrote a smash yet.
Right.
So, except like the Pia stuff is going good. I'm doing all her stuff because that's like more pop. So then I was just like, fuck it. I met Josh again. We had grown up together and he starts being like, get in my ear, like I'm gonna manage you. You got to get out of this band situation.
Have you been
managing
anybody else?
No.
Or like, where did that idea come from?
I don't know. He had been doing like finance, like slaving, and he got tired of it. And he was living in Vegas, and like he was like an amateur, semi pro golfer. Also,
get out.
My manager Chachi. And he
Josh,
was.
Josh, you're so athletic.
Yeah, he is. It's crazy. It's
He's
weird.
Sitting in the room, guys. That's why I'm talking. Okay, proceed.
But he kind of was getting in my ear, like, do you, like, just be yourself,
right?
You know, even Knick Knack, like everything that he has, that's great. But don't do that all day. You have to find your own shit, and I'm gonna rock with you. And as ever since I had him, and we started going off, and then I'd be like, I'd be making demos, and be like, that could be my song too. You know, and then finally we were like, fuck it, let's drop something on SoundCloud. So I did it, and I did like a straight, if you go all the way to the bottom of my SoundCloud, the first song is called Andy Griffith. Mm-hmm. If you want to know if Marky Bassey has bars, go to the first two or three songs. It's all hip hop, you know, straight like 16 bar verses with a little singing hook.
Mm-hmm.
First one has no hook. People kind of fucked with it a little bit, and then I made a weird song called Chemical High that was more like interesting production, and it was produced by, and that's where Count Basie comes in, someone I'd also grown up with but hadn't ever connected with musically, but someone I just knew who would send me beats. And so I put out this song called Chemical High, and I remember I came home one day, it was like a really bad day, I was like, damn, my shit got like 711 plays today versus like 30 plays a day for all the other songs. Like, I know it's not shit, but I was like, that's kind of tight. Like, someone other than my immediate friend circle checked for this song. Then the next day, I was like, damn, I got like, you know, 1,100 plays today. And it kind of just like grew.
Yeah.
So then I was like, we're going to do this. So me and Josh were like, okay, you're going to be a songwriter, but we're going to just work this SoundCloud shit and see where the SoundCloud shit kind of takes you.
Right.
And it's just kind of started bubbling, just started growing. And I started getting, I started just realizing, like, okay, Marky Bassey is going to be an artist. That's going to be something you actually do. And so while you're building like this network of musical resources by writing for other people. And now I got a bunch of random credits. Like, I've written on for some pop, Alan Stone. I mean, for some pop Pia Mia shit, but also like Alan Stone. That's,
hey,
like,
we did a Knox City thing with Alan Stone. That's my dog.
Yeah. I did a song on his last album called Guardian Angel.
Yeah, he's dope, man. He's a really cool guy too.
Amazing talent. Yeah,
great band.
Great. Yeah. He's a fucking insane singer and guitar player. Yeah. So I was doing shit like, I'm over here with him, like with these kind of producers. So I have this network of people that it's, again, like a community around me. Like, they fuck with me, you know, so I can call on people like, can I get studio time over here? Like, me and Josh always make sure like we're cool. We're down with the engineers, like the people that that we take care of people. They take care of us.
Exactly. I always say, like, I like to ask for favors and not leave any footprints on the carpet. You know what I mean? So, like, you know, people always know, like, oh, yeah, if they come in, that they'll be respectful and treat shit good and they leave it how they left it. You know what I mean? And, like, I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where, like, if you never leave a bad taste in somebody's mouth, you can always get favors pulled.
Yeah. So that's kind of where it was. And that takes us to, like, the past year, I guess. And then me and Count Basie just really were, like, I was like, bro, you need to come down to L.A. And he's like, no, I'm not doing that.
Is he was still up in the Bay?
He was designing clothes for Thrasher.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wait, isn't Thrasher based down in Carlsbad or something?
I don't know. He was designing in San Francisco.
Okay.
And he was up there. He was doing, he had his own clothing company. He was designing. He wasn't making very much money.
Yeah.
But he was doing smooth. And he was just like, I don't fuck with, like, doing music for life. He's like one of those kind of people. He didn't think that was, like,
a realistic option.
A realistic thing.
Yeah.
It's not really.
It isn't.
It's not.
I'm always trying to do it. I'm always trying to preach that to the listeners. Like, don't do it. Find another interesting way to be involved. I always tell people the smarter route is what this guy's doing. What Josh is doing.
Like, he's a smart motherfucker.
That's the real route is get into some management.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's very true.
Yeah.
But if you're an artist, find a manager who only fucks with you.
Right, exactly.
That's only because that's what me and Josh have that I notice other artists don't have that. And you can have I have a big boss manager too. But, like, me and Josh are, like, that's, you know, we're one team. And, like, having someone who, if you're an artist, you need someone to, like, tell you that you're good.
Right.
You know, someone that really rides for you. That shit's really important. So, I don't know. The music, I just started to find a sound. And Count Basie is just a really talented producer. And then I also have Nick Knack. We sleep, his room is right next to my room. So,
I'm around him. Lately here.
No. What?
Nothing. Never
mind. Oh, yeah. Back to that again.
We sleep.
I'm just saying, like, we're,
yeah,
like,
you're
we,
in the
we
same
turn,
house.
We turn up together every day. You know, I live in this, in a sort of advanced musical commune shelter where a lot of shit goes down. It's in the crib, like it's in his room.
Yeah,
my other it's called the back house where we live, and it's always a party in there. It's crazy.
That's dope.
But a lot of, like, we probably sold, like, I mean, Loyal, Ayo, the Chris Brown Tiger joint, Bitches and Marijuana, like, all those joints got made right next, you know.
That's so crazy.
My wall is, like, right there. Nick's in there making those. All of Pia's music got made there. Pia's gonna be the next Rihanna.
I mean, that,
like,
song
she's
"Do
crazy.
It Again" is, like, always on the radio right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we made that there, you know.
Yeah.
And
it's funny because I have this big Uso homie, like this big Samoan dude, AG. Shout out AG, and we travel on photo shoots a lot together. And he, like, heavy fucks with, like, modern reggae, so he's always playing J-Boog shit.
Yeah.
And so that's the only reason I knew that song, because I'm not really involved in that scene too much. So I hear the Pia Mia version, and I'm like, wait, I know this song. And I hit him up, like, I'm like, oh shit, AG. I'm like, are you fucking stoked that that song's on the radio?
Are you
pissed? But he also, I was like, are you stoked that fucking Your Blood, Chris Brown, is on that shit too or what? And he's like, nah, man, that shit's dope. I fucks with it. He's like, anything to get the music out there, like, he's hyped on it.
Yeah, I would say, for the record too, I just spent a week riding with J-Boog and this band, the Comic Kings, in Miami.
Yeah.
And we turned up for 7 straight days, no sleep, full fucking gallons of Tangeray and everything. And, like, we, you know, J-Boog is incredible.
Yeah.
And so is this band, the Common Kings. And
they have such a fucking huge, loyal fan base.
Yeah, and I really respect that music. And, like, the reason that we've probably written, like, 100 songs with Pia for Pia. And the reason that we did that is because that was her favorite song. And we all fucked with that song. And we were trying to figure out a way to, like, interpolate it. But I was honestly, as a writer myself, I was like, it has more integrity to just cover the shit and give him his fucking, you know, break him off, that publishing.
Yeah.
And we did. And then we contacted him, and he was down with it. And he lives in the Bay, so he knows we're all from the Bay, so it's all love. He's from Compton, though, but J-Boog is.
Oh,
but,
no shit.
Yeah, so he's from down here, but he fucks with the Bay, and the Bay fucks with him heavy. I mean, the whole world does now. And I got to hear his new album, too. His album is insane. Like,
dope.
It is going to make fans out of non-reggae
dope
fans, too. So,
hell yeah.
You know, I love his music, and I'm glad that that didn't go the other way where people are like, fuck you. But Pia has a lot of integrity too as an artist, so it
Yeah.
It went the way it was supposed to.
My friends that are into the modern reggae scene, they fuck with the PMEA version of it, and they're happy about it. So there you go.
I'm glad.
Yeah, that's dope. So, yeah, you start finding your own voice, and how do you start navigating, like, into, like, did you already have PR on deck, and, like, would it be, like, or did you guys have to rebuild from scratch?
No, yeah, we just fully rebuilt everything. Yeah, yeah. Me and Josh done everything. I had a publishing deal as a writer.
Yeah.
So I knew, like, A&Rs and stuff, and I started to tell people, like, I'm gonna do this artist stuff too. We played like a little residency. Me and Nick Nack did like 3 or 4 shows in the Bay together. There was like 700 people, like fucking crazy, like
damn.
Energy.
Yeah.
And then I just really got back to basics with the Bay. HBK, G-Eazy, anything that's happening in the Bay, you know, all of them just fully embraced. Like, I could never get the Bay to embrace my band.
Yeah.
Because it was just too much weird shit going on. Yeah. And they were like, come on, bro. Like, what?
Dude, yeah.
This is so.
Did you come up knowing G-Eazy and HBK guys and all that? Or is it just like,
I mean, sort
recently
of.
Met them?
I met them in the last like 5 years.
Okay.
G, I met in the last like 2 years or something. But,
yeah.
But me and Nick go back a long time now.
Right.
But I'm like, you know, like 2 years older than that, than this whole the new Bay Area scene. But they've just fully like embraced my music, and
yeah.
So because I have the Bay with me, it's the best. Like, you know, I can at any time, like, we can go, we can tour together. I'm about to go out with Kehlani.
Oh yeah,
I did a joint with Kehlani like a year ago before she was really popping. That was like one of her most popular songs.
I've been trying to reach out to their squad forever to get her on here. So put in a good word if you have a good time.
I will.
But yeah, actually, our dude Pell is on the road with her right
now. Pell. Yeah, Pell lives next door to the Basie house.
Oh no shit.
Yeah, we live in the same.
Yeah, we had him on. Great kid. I love Pell.
Yeah, that was really dope.
Yeah. So yeah, you just put out a project though, right?
So I put out a mixtape like a year ago, and then that was called what the fuck is that? Only the Poets.
Uh-huh.
and that shit was dope, different. We shot 2 videos for it, and that's when we started to get like real SoundCloud following and real plays and people talking about it and blogs writing about it. And then we started working with Michelle, and just she kind of helped us really pop it off, and now we got this new thing that just came out like, I don't know,
a month and a half, 2 months ago.
Nah, less, longer than that. East Hollywood only came out a month and a half ago. No way.
Yeah, I think so. It's pretty fucking new, man.
Yeah, so you know, I met up with Kendrick. I played it for him before it came out. He fucked with all my songs. He's such a solid fucking
How does something like that get hooked up?
That's just more like, you know, my homegirl been grinding out here for a while, and she works at with TDE and at Interscope. She
Ashley?
No, her name's Chelsea.
Oh, okay, never mind.
She does A&R for like TDE for Schoolboy and for Kendrick. And she had just played in my music, and you know, it's always been easier. Like, real hip hop heads fuck with my music more than like who
pop
you would think.
Right,
they understand me more.
Yeah.
Because that's what I grew up listening to. And Kendrick's someone that I really like.
Well, when go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, when I listened to the project, I felt I could tell that you had a rap background somewhere. Like, I felt like, oh, this is a dude who probably started as a rapper who realized that there's no fucking there's not the right road for him or the right inlay there for the rap, and also knew he could sing and has developed that over time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's exactly.
Yeah, so.
So well put.
Yeah. I don't know. But anyway, so Kendrick hears it.
So yeah, Kendrick hears it, and he was just like, you know, I fuck with it. And that meant a lot to me, just to like, he's like, listen to 10 of my songs. Like,
yeah.
I've been in sessions with Chris Brown, and like, you can't really play Chris Brown a song. He's going to play you 5 hours of amazing music and like sing and dance, and you're just going to be like, oh my God, this motherfucker is crazy.
Yeah.
But Kendrick was like, just play, you know, play your shit, whatever. He's not going to play you what he's working on.
Right.
It's like the opposite.
Top secret.
Yeah. So I played in my shit, and he was into it, and that was a good, just like, you know, I mean, I don't need someone to like co-sign my shit to feel good about it. And I didn't even know he was going to tweet anything about it.
But it still feels good when someone you respect respects you back, you know?
And he's one of those people that, you know, to me in the music industry, there's always like, I'm at an interesting age because the kids, like, music is dumbed down. It gets more and more dumbed down every year. Like, from the, you know, from musical, from classical music, from the only way you could see music 500 years ago was to go watch a symphony, to now it's just continuously getting dumbed down. And there's no, that's not bad. That just is, you know? And dumbed down, it shouldn't be called dumbed down. It should just be called.
I would argue that it's evolving.
Okay,
it's
sure.
Being democratized, perhaps it's easier for everyone to make music now.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but to me, I come from like where skills still matter.
Absolutely.
And energy is not paramount. Skip pantamount, whatever.
Yeah. So I don't know. One of those.
I really like the cats like Miguel, Drake, Kendrick, J. Cole, fucking Anderson. Like, you know, these people that I find out here who really, like, I can tell, like, holy shit. Alan Stone, like, you...
They got chops.
You're hard and you have skills.
Yeah.
That I fuck with that. I want to be in that world. You know, I love that exists also. And the cats who just turn up, like, that's its own... That's, like, a stylistic skill that is also equally important. But it doesn't appeal to my ear as much. And, like... You know, even like I just slapped a new Future album, and it's like I'm not gonna go out there and be like, "This is the greatest fucking album." Like,
oh really?
I turn up, but like everyone says that that's their favorite album.
My favorite of his is Monster. I'll ride for Monster to the death. I love that shit.
This album is like I'm not like a music critic.
Yeah.
This is no like
no,
Future's amazing. It's not like that. He's changed like. All of music
right.
and made everyone
right, of course.
Want to do that. But it's like, I'm not from Atlanta. I don't sip lean.
Yeah.
Like, I go to the club and have fun and listen to Future just like anybody else. But like, I still want to listen to like music also. And that's where my ear gravitates. So Kendrick, that's my favorite shit.
Yeah.
Because it's like, and my friends don't even like Kendrick. You know, in my house, they'd much rather slap Future all fucking day.
Right.
Just like everyone in LA, you know, and that's great. But, well, Kendrick also.
Yeah.
He's like damn near the king of LA. But Kendrick to me is just someone where it's like, I can't do that.
Right, right.
You know? Yeah. Future, I can't swag like Future. I'm not as fly as Future, but I can do that, sort of.
Right, right.
You know, I could imitate that. But when I listen to Kendrick, it's like, I'd probably have to sit with this album every day for a year to regurgitate it back to you.
Right.
And give you all the words back.
Right.
And give you all the chords. And like, it's just so much there. It's like nutritious music, lyrically, musically. And that's fucking great to me. And that, what that does to people that actually, like, if you're a little kid in the hood somewhere in LA and you like, and you're 10 years old and you hear To Pimp a Butterfly and that's your favorite thing, for your mind to like tackle what that is and you listen to that every day, you're gonna get smarter.
Right.
Your brain's gonna get sharper. You're gonna be like, what was he talking about right here, here, and here? Why'd he say that shit about that? Why he's talking about this gang stuff, like what's really going on? And that's how it was for me growing up. You know, that's when I listened to Pac and the music that I gravitated towards, that's what was happening. I got a solid education off rap music.
Yeah.
And, you know, to this day I have beliefs and ideas about how this country should be working and, you know, how our government should act and how businesses should treat employees and how workers should be treated and all types of ideas and thoughts. They directly come from like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you can't get that out of a lot of music now.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, like, I want to be someone who's out there saying that, because everyone is just like, yeah, I just fucked your bitch and my Gucci flip-flops, like that's tight too, you know. But like, we're grown ass people,
right.
You know. I'm a fucking 28 year old white boy from fucking Marin. Like,
yeah.
I'm not just gonna be all the way out here
right
banging for that. Like, that's someone else's life, and I do that shit actually in my real life. But
please don't fuck my bitch and Gucci.
I won't but
leave,
but
my, it's not, leave it's her not, alone.
It's not beyond me to like, I turn up
yeah
the most with
not
you know, but I'm just saying, like, so I don't want to make it seem like I don't like, you know, I
right.
love, I fucking,
you fuck with everything, but I you fuck, do
but,
you
but yeah and
you're
I
doing you.
I just I really love the little spark that I see of that like nutritious music coming back, and I want to be that's
part
like
of that.
The wave that I want to kind of ride in, and so I'm
right.
happy that it exists in LA. And this is not a knock on any kind of, like, I love all that other music too, but I'm just saying personally for myself.
Yeah, you're
hopefully
happy
this will turn into like a crazy beef one day.
There's like a good wave of talented musicians coming out of Los Angeles, and it's a good scene and a good vibe to be around. For certain.
Yeah.
And I think that people in this scene are going to know your name.
Yeah.
Even more so very soon.
Yeah, me too.
So, tell the people where to find the last project.
Everything is just soundcloud.com/MARC Mark_E_Basie. That's Bassy. But really just Google Mark E. Basie and you'll find everything.
Yeah, it's a very Googleable name.
Can't miss it.
Yeah, the last project is good. What is it called? East Hollywood?
It's called East Hollywood. The East Hollywood EP.
Oh, yeah. East Hollywood EP. And it's about like 10 or 11 tracks?
I don't know.
Anyway, it was good. I listened to it twice.
Thank you.
And I liked it.
Thank you.
Why I invited you on here, and I'm glad that you guys came.
Awesome.
Where else can the people find you? Like on Twitter and shit?
Yeah, at Marky Basie on Instagram and on Twitter.
On Twitter and Instagram. There you go. What's next for you? The tour with Kalani?
I'm going on tour with Kalani, and I'll have another EP dropping before the year is over. And then I'll have a real...
Putting in work.
Yeah, I'm putting in work. I just did a deal. I could say that now.
Are you allowed to announce it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I
signed a record deal with Universal Republic.
Congrats, man.
Home of the Weeknd.
Another
amazing artist that his music is nutritious in its own way.
Yeah.
I'll have my debut Marky Basie solo album will be out. I haven't really told anyone that yet publicly, so that's cool. You heard it here first.
I just dropped bombs. Yeah. Well, fantastic, man. I'm happy for you.
Yeah,
it's dope.
It's
dope when you like meet someone who's been around for a while and doing it and just didn't give up because, you know, the more you can't stop. And, you know, the more you fail, the more likely you are for something great to happen. And it's great to see people that get the failures out of the way early and stick with it.
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
I don't know.
No,
Did that sound negative or positive? That was supposed to sound positive.
No, it sounds very positive. I still not doing this is just not an option for me. So I've never viewed it as like, it's always it's a win-win. Like if I can get by and get through life financially, like how I've been doing, making songs, that's a win.
Yeah.
And if my shit pops off and I'm, you know, in Sweden in 8 months in front of 100,000 people singing on my guitar, that's
a win too.
That's like an out of this world type win.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Mm-hmm. Well, what song are you going to perform tonight? That was the question.
I'm just going to do this brand new song I just wrote called Wonder If We're Having Fun.
Exclusive.
Yeah.
I need sound effects.
Yeah, you do.
All right, dope. What's it called? I'm sorry, I missed it.
It's called I Wonder If We're Having Fun.
I Wonder If We're Having Fun. So you guys can go to youtube.com/kindaneat and watch Mark E. Basie perform I Wonder If We're Having Fun. And you guys already know, my name is Lee. Some of you guys know me as Intuition. You can follow me on Twitter at It's Intuition. You can follow my man, Ben Shim, behind the boards, making the shit sound buttery at I Am Data Base, base with two S's. But no E. Or no Y.
Yeah.
Anyhow, you can follow us as a unit at Kinda Neat. YouTube.com/KindaNeat, where you're going to see Mark E. Basie perform. And if you are listening to this on your computer, I told somebody on Twitter that I would stop saying you're doing it wrong. But I feel like you should listen to it on your phone. So download that podcast app, subscribe to Kinda Neat, and leave a 5-star rating and a review. Tell us who you want to see on the show. And I don't know. I think that's everything. I think we did what we came to accomplish. Learned a lot about you. I had no idea. I thought you were just like some new out of the blue cat, you know, like some young kid. And here you are, the fucking grizzled vet.
Yeah, I'm very much a vet.
There you go.
Now, thank you for having me. This is the first sort of in-depth conversation I've ever had.
Ever with anyone. That's crazy. Like, you live alone
on air. but as Marky Basie, like, I haven't really got to tell my story. So
yeah, well,
it's
I'm glad I'm glad that we were allowed to be the first one, man. And I feel like you're gonna have, like, eventually you'll have the famous interviewers talking to you. You'll be do like five fingers of death
we'll
or something. Fuck, I hope so, man. We'll see.
Anyhow,
that was Mark. I'm Lee. That's weird. My producer's name is Mark, so I always say Mark and Lee a lot. But anyway, that's Mark. I'm Lee, and this was Kinda Neat.